According to the 1899 reminiscence of Alexander Bankhead, an LDS slave, the slaves in Salt Lake in the 1850s often congregated together in a hall on State Street and 300 South. They met to discuss the deplorable conditions under which they lived as slaves, to trade stories about how their masters treated them, with Bankhead noting that many of them were subjected to the same treatment that was accorded to plantation Negroes of the South, to discuss ways to adjust to the dry, arid, high desert climate, and to dream of ways of escaping through the snow-capped mountains that were intimidating and overwhelming barricade. Occasionally, a slave would attempt to escape, but they were always caught and returned to their Mormon masters. For example, in June of 1856, just as the Mormon Reformation was heating up, a slave named Dan escaped from Williams, Washington camp. When Camp recovered Dan, Dan accused Camp of kidnapping him. Brigham Young even stepped in, interviewing Salt Lake County Sheriff Jesse C. Little and U.S. Marshal Robert T. Burton about the kidnapping charges. Eventually, though, Camp was able to provide evidence that he, in fact, owned Dan and was acquitted of the kidnapping charge.
He's a criminal prosecutor and Mormon historian. She's podcaster and executive director of Sunstone. Join Lindsay Hansen Park and John Dinger for Mormon History, Crime, and Punishment Stories. This is Season 1.
The murder of Dr. Robinson. We've been building up to this, and on last episode, John Dinger and I briefly told the skeleton outline of the story, but now we're ready to get into it. I really want to get into a more detailed retelling of it, just to make sure nothing is lost. So I'm really excited to introduce Michael McLean. I've been trying to get you to come on the podcast for a while. I've been a fan of your work for a while now. And so I have someone, a historian who knows about this story, who is willing to come talk to us about it. So Michael, say hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So right now you're coming to us from New Zealand, but you initially wrote about this when you were living in Salt Lake.
I did. Yeah, I grew up in Salt Lake City. I kind of came to this subject by way of my master's thesis for the Environmental Humanities Program, which seems like an odd combination, but I was writing about Beck Street, and a big part of why Robinson died had to do with Beck Street. So
it has been hard to find anyone who has talked about the story so clearly and concisely as you have, so I'm really glad that you're taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk about this. So why don't we get into the story? You just give us a basic telling, and then we can link to some of the projects you've done, because you worked on a project called Mapping Salt Lake City. Mapping Salt Lake, right?
That's correct. I didn't actually, I was a contributor to the site, I should say. It was Paisley Rechdahl, who is currently our poet laureate there in Utah, and some of her students who really built it and kind of fleshed it out. I was one of the students in her class that basically the work we created in that class became the first contributions to that site.
Okay, so let's get into this murder. Why don't you tell us the character, set it up for us?
So Dr. J.K. Robinson, J. King Robinson, was a doctor in a number of eastern states who eventually came to Salt Lake City after the Civil War. He was based out of Fort Douglas. He came over with Johnson's Army. And this was during what would have been known as the Utah War. So as I'm guessing a lot of your listeners probably already know, there was a long kind of standoff between Brigham Young and the federal government. And he had gone from being the territorial governor to not being the governor. And now he was back to being the governor by the time King arrives. And so King is discharged from the army in, I believe it was 1865. And at this point, he's looking to set up a hospital somewhere in Salt Lake City. A number of things have transpired in terms of oversight from the federal government. The Organic Act, which I think is, I believe it's 1853 or 1854, kind of brings Utah back under the auspices of the federal government in terms of land distribution and overseeing how land is used. Despite that happening, Brigham Young and the Mormon Church are still largely kind of in control of what's happening in Salt Lake, even after Johnson's army and other federal agents arrive.
So the government is passing these laws about property because Mormons are trying to consolidate all of the property that they can. And they had successfully been doing that in the Utah Territory before Robinson arrives, right?
That's correct. Yeah, they had been laying out plats throughout the city, you know, right from the get-go in 1847. And they had been distributing to members of the church and to new arrivals. And the city had kind of had blossomed from those first, the first three plats, A, B, and C, made up about 19 wards in the city. The 19th ward, which would have been James Hendricks' ward, where Robinson was looking for land out along the Beck Street area, which was then known as Warm Springs. It wasn't called Beck Street yet. But that those kind of early land distribution plants had grown significantly and many more pieces of land had distributed. And the Mormons were really trying to consolidate as much as they could in the city. Obviously, the federal government was realizing there were resources and opportunities to be had here, and we're trying to put an end to that.
So Robinson, this all starts over basically a plot of land. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. At this point in time, there's this really strong belief in what's called medical geography. And this is this idea that certain places have particular healing powers. And hot springs are really kind of primary among those places. You know, by this point, a bathhouse has existed out in the Warm Springs area on those springs that are out there for a decade and a half. It's been trading hands back and forth between private and public hands for that entire period. A whole series of bad owners are kind of over this land. At this point in time, it's back in the hands of essentially the city, really Brigham Young. But the bathhouse has been relocated a little southeast of the location that Robinson's looking at. And so again, he's looking for a place for a hospital. You know, he's been working as a doctor for the army. He knows that there's a lot of people traveling across the plains and people that need a place to be treated for a number of conditions and injuries and things that result from these extensive travels. And he thinks that the hot springs is the perfect place because of this notion of them having particular healing properties. So he builds a little shack out on the Warm Springs property there where there had been no buildings before. And there was a particular law in place saying that in order to be able to make a claim on a land, you had to develop it. So that's why he immediately builds this shack. And he also wants to build the first bowling alley in Salt Lake City. Now, why a hospital and a bowling alley together? That's lost to history. He must have just been a particular fan of the game. And it's when he builds this shack that the problems start.
There's also another piece, which is he gets acquainted with and marries a Mormon woman. So the land, you know, a Gentile getting land, and then the fact that we've mentioned earlier in the podcast that he married Ellen Kay, who's a daughter, the 18-year-old daughter of a Mormon polygamist, Dr. John Kay, that didn't sit well with people. So what happens next?
So the first thing that happens is the police, who are at that point likely to be majority Mormon, if not entirely, come in and burn the shack and the beginnings of the bowling alley down. Everything that he's developed, they burn it down. You know, obviously Robinson is distraught over this. You know, he makes some complaints to the federal government over what's happening. But not much happens in the intervening, I forget the amount of time exactly that passes between that being burned down and his eventual death. Very little happens. He doesn't start to rebuild. You know, his complaints are just kind of out in the ether waiting for a response from the feds.
This is not an atypical story. A lot of, as we talked about in this podcast, Utah had a reputation now. Mormons had a reputation that they were not safe for outsiders. And of course, Robinson happens after Mountain Meadows, so there's already this uneasiness of being an outsider. So how are his complaints heard?
Well, he felt that he had gone through all the proper channels. You know, he was obeying the letter of the law, of course, but he was not beholden to was kind of Mormon tradition in the city. You know, he was not one of them. That was land that, despite the series of owners that had been there and the series of projects and kind of industrial and recreational uses that had taken place there, he was an outsider. And the fact that he had connections to the army made things all the more tense. People really resented him for his connections to Johnson and to others up at Fort Douglas. So basically, the complaints that he makes to the police end in his development's being burnt down. The complaints that he makes to the federal government receive no response. He has really no recourse in this situation.
So does he fight back at all? Does he cause any more problems? Does he go peacefully in the night? What happens?
Well, he not especially. I mean, I think he takes the burning down of the property as kind of a signal. My understanding is he doesn't have a lot of contact with, you know, either the lay government in the city or the police or Young or anybody in church leadership. But it was enough to raise the ire, certainly of, you know, Young, who, well, we can talk about this more in a minute, but whether he called out the Danites and, or, you know, Porter Rockwell or somebody like that is still up to speculation.
So let's talk about the evening of his murder. Do you want to set that up for us?
Yeah. So on October 22nd, 1866, Robinson is at home. It is kind of late evening, pretty quiet night in the city because the circus is in town. And so a lot of people in the city are out attending the circus, and a lot of the police in the city are, and this is, it will become an important detail, are either patrolling the circus or actually attending it themselves. So Robinson is at home, just resting at the end of a long day, and there's a knock at his front door.
So there's a knock at the door in the middle of the night, which would not have been completely unusual for a doctor or a surgeon.
No. And he answers the door, and a witness in Robinson's home says that somebody that neither of them recognized was at the door. There was a man there that claimed he, his brother, who he referred to as, I believe, John Jones, needed medical attention. And so Robinson, being, you know, the good doctor that he was, grabbed his bags and anything else in his jacket and headed out to go provide some medical attention to this person.
So they take him, I forget the street now. They take him to a street downtown.
Yeah. I forget Robinson's exact address now, but he lives very close to Broadway in Maine. And so he heads out with this man, and at the corner of, or at the intersection of Main Street and Third South or Broadway, he's approached by several other men. One of the individuals clubs Robinson over the head. Another person pulls out a gun and shoots him after he's been clubbed. The few witnesses that were there claim to have seen somewhere between 5 to 7 men. Nobody could name any names. Nobody could identify any faces. Very few details were given by the witnesses aside from 5 to 7 men. Somebody hit him over the head. Another person shot him.
As we talk about in this podcast, all of a sudden the witnesses disappear. Nobody knows anything. Brigham Young doesn't know anything. Why, though, did the rest of the country suspect almost immediately the Mormons and Brigham Young for his murder?
Well, that's a complicated answer. But, yeah, a number of things come into play there. First of all, again, the occupation of Fort Douglas by the United States Army in ostensibly to kind of keep the Mormons on their best behavior. So there was a lot of tension there. We had already, you know, at this point, we're less than a decade removed from the Mountain Meadows Massacre, which is its whole other enormous can of worms. But there's still a lot of tension taking place there between the government, the government on the ground in Utah, led by Brigham Young, and the federal government. You know, Robinson was not the first person to squat on lands, at least from the Mormons' point of view. You know, according to the federal government, these people are making legitimate land claims. According to the Mormons, they're squatters who, you know, they're not only, from Young's point of view, not only are they Gentiles, but they're stealing land from the Mormons, which, Brigham Young had a pretty fierce temper. So a lot of people in the U.S. figured that, you know, by this point, people already know about Porter Rockwell. They know about Lott Smith and Bill Hickman. The rumors about the Danites and the Destroying Angels are already, you know, the papers are eating that stuff up. And so people are aware of this stuff. And so it's easy to look at this and go, okay, this is a guy who not only squatted on land that belonged to the Mormons, but he squatted on land that was important to their history in terms of, you know, this is a place where people would go get baptized. And it was very important spiritually to them. And so he was not only squatting, but he was rubbing their face in it. So at that point, It's pretty easy for people to look at this and say, okay, this was a Brigham Young called a hit, basically.
I'm going to ask you to do something historians hate to do, and that's speculate. But do you see any evidence of Brigham Young being responsible, Porter Rockwell being involved? There's whispers that Porter Rockwell was involved, and there's a theory, and I think Bagley has this theory, which is nothing happened in the territory of Utah without Brigham Young knowing about it.
Well, I'll admit readily that I subscribe to Bagley's theory about that, particularly in Salt Lake City. But I, you know, there's a couple of things here that give me pause. That's that this is not a typical, from what we do know of Rockwell or Lott Smith or Bill Hickman, this is not a typical job for them. Now, could it be that the witnesses were lying and there was really just one person who clubbed Robinson over the head and then shot him? Sure. Of course, that could be the case. The likelihood that other members of the church covered up for crimes committed by either Danites or the Destroying Angels, that's entirely possible. But if it really was 5 to 7 men, that's strange. That's a strange detail, because that's not how Rockwell, that's not how he liked to operate, according to the myths, at least. Certainly not how he operated in jobs like trying to kill Lilburn Boggs and other things like that. So I should have mentioned that earlier. Actually, Boggs was, the extermination order was still on the books, and it remained on the books until the 1970s. But the extermination order towards Mormons in Missouri was still on the books when they had sent the army into Utah to occupy things. So there was still lingering resentment over that. And that made Rockwell a national figure. I mean, his attempted killing of Lilburn Boggs had already made him kind of a mythical person in not just the West, but throughout the country. But anyway, back to your question. Yeah, the fact that there were 5 to 7 men, at least according to witness statements, is very strange. I've got to believe that this was a hit job, just because there was no other... He wasn't, okay, he had valuables on him. He wasn't robbed. This wasn't a crime of opportunity. He was left lying there, bleeding to death in the street with his wallet and watch and all his other valuables still on him. It's not like they went back and robbed his house. They weren't going after any assets or any valuables of his. This was to make a point. I think it was to make an example of, for people who were considering doing similar actions on Mormon land.
Do we want to talk about his headstone? What it said?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, tell us about his headstone, because I think that that's an interesting detail.
Yeah, so Robinson is the first person, well, the first homicide victim to be buried in the Fort Douglas Cemetery. But his headstone is interesting because it reads, "In memory of Dr. J. King Robinson, who was assassinated October 22nd, 1866, aged 50 years." Then there's a quote underneath, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." And that's a quote I'm guessing your listeners will likely be familiar with.
Vengeance is mine. What was the rest of it?
I will repay, saith the Lord.
I will repay. So interesting.
So there's a couple of things
that
are really
interesting.
Yeah. So particularly people who are familiar with Mormon history are going to remember that following the Mountain Meadows Massacre, when federal agents come in and find the bodies of people that were killed in the meadow that have been scattered around by coyotes or else just left out in the open, they create this memorial. They create a mass grave and from the remains that they can find, and they build a memorial on top of it. Well, shortly thereafter, Young comes down to see the memorial and to visit this place. He says, he repeats that same quote, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And instead he says, what it should say is, "Vengeance is mine and I have taken a little," which, most people interpret to mean, he got his revenge through this massacre.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think leaves kind of a strange question mark at the end of this murder. Can you tell me how you think that this murder impacted Utah? That's kind of a broad question.
Well, one of the other thing I was going to say about the headstone plays into the answer to that question. That is the word "assassinated," really key here. That was strategic on the part of the people who were mourning and who buried Robinson. This, the use of the word "assassination" takes away any doubt that this was a crime of opportunity. This was politically motivated, or in this case, potentially religiously motivated. And so that's a forceful statement on the part of the people who created that headstone. So this is, not only is this, I think, a really great example of the notion of blood atonement, which we didn't talk about in too much detail here, but certainly Brigham Young was an advocate of blood atonement, this idea that there are certain crimes which can only be repaid in spilling the blood of the perpetrator. And, I mentioned his temper before. He did not suffer people treading on his authority lightly, and certainly Robinson did that here. Would that be enough for Young to say this is a blood atonement crime? That's the pure speculation. Somebody killed Robinson, and it certainly seems to have been politically motivated. So I would say yes, this probably is an instance of blood atonement.
Yeah, and I'd really like to explore further with you sometime the idea of blood atonement used as a theological atonement, right, for sin versus, as we talk about in this podcast, the lynching of Thomas Coleman that results right after Dr. Robinson and Dr. Robinson's murder, and the murders of so many other people who, I think the ritual killings is something that needs a further examination, but everyone's afraid to touch it because it's such a heavy topic. So I appreciate you being willing to come on and talk about this. I think this was such a stupid political move on the part of the Mormons because it brings a lot of ire, a lot of federal pressure, a lot of fear onto the Mormons. And that's when it really get started for them. I think Mountain Meadows was one thing, but it was a really complicated, confusing thing for them to investigate and to clean up. From the time of Mountain Meadows to Robinson's murder, and Robinson's murder, I think, handed the government everything they needed to sort of move in. Do you think that's fair to say?
I think that's fair. And this is, the killing of an army doctor in cold blood in a city that already was under intense scrutiny. If I would agree with you, if Young did call for this to happen, it was a huge strategic error on his part, because he was already under the microscope, and it would, Young only lasts a few more years after this. And, whether the scrutiny that he was under and the relationship with the federal government kind of hastened Brigham Young's end, again, that's speculation, but this was, certainly, if he called for this to happen, it was a big strategic error.
Well, thank you again for this fascinating retelling. It's such an important and very forgotten story in Mormonism. And I just really appreciate you taking the time, Michael. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, this case tells us a lot of interesting things about Mormon justice and mountain law, if you will.
Like the fact that the murder was done under lamplight on the street in the dead of night, like some Jack the Ripper novel. Yeah, okay, so this is kind of a nerdy thing, but I looked this up. It's legit. Street lamps in Salt Lake begun in 1866 with candles, and then the lights were converted to coal oil, which is kerosene, in 1867. So gas lighting was installed in 1873, and everything was switched to electricity in 1882, so it was kind of spooky.
Yeah, very Jack the Ripper. There's more that we can extrapolate. This case was so important to Utah history and the history of the West. It also really goes with a theme here about extra legal justice, being the only justice found in Utah. Dr. Robinson tried to do everything right. He made a legal claim, he tried to go through the courts. It was only when he threatened appeal, meaning seeking legal redress from non-Mormons or Gentiles, that he got killed. I think it illustrates how bad it was, how the local judiciary was really just illusory. And the historian Brigham D. Madsen stated, this really did create an enemy of the church, Robert Baskin. While everyone may not know who he is, Brigham Young would have put him on the Mount Rushmore of enemies, right along with William Law, John C. Bennett, and Emma Smith.
Oh, I like that. The Mount Rushmore of enemies and Baskin's face. I mean, he's the guy that we've been reading, the judge we've been reading these accounts from, right? Do you know that historian Connell O'Donovan actually traces this story to the racist lynching and violent murder of Thomas Coleman?
Yeah, and we need to tell this story. It's important.
Well, it's delicate because I want to be careful not to use the story of a lynching of a black man carelessly. It's such a terrible story. I think I've done that before. So I'm going to let my friend Misha McGriggs help with this. She helped me initially research this story for an earlier project. And she's also a clinical psychologist and does trainings at Columbia and other consulting on racial issues. So she's kind of amazing. I'm excited to be interviewing a good friend of mine, Dr. Misha McGriggs. Misha, can you say hello?
Hey, everybody.
Now, we talked about this story years ago on another podcast project, so it's been a while, but you helped me research the lynching of Thomas Coleman.
Yeah, that was a tragic but fascinating piece of history for sure. That intersection of the Black community, the enslaved community, and the white Mormon community in Utah.
So you use the word enslaved, and I remember, you know, thank you for giving us that quote at the beginning of the episode, but you had problems with the quote, not necessarily because of the history, but the way that it told the history. Do you want to kind of tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the history and the writings that we're referencing and that we're looking at are not too dated, but in the last couple of years, historians have really shifted their language, and sociologists have really kind of shifted their language to using person first or person centered language. And if you say slave, it is an erasure of the humanity of an enslaved person. And so a lot of folks who are writing about the history of enslavement in America or throughout the Black diaspora are using person centered language, which would be to say enslaved persons or enslaved peoples.
Okay, got it. So that's helpful in how we talk about this too. That's something that I didn't know, but it makes sense because slave is more a noun, enslaved is like a verb almost, or an adjective. It's acting upon someone else, which is what slavery was.
Right. It really, I think in writing, even though obviously these tragedies are done and we're still kind of living with the consequences of transatlantic slavery, at a minimum, we can take that subject and make it agentic in some ways just by the act of how we refer to those people, because indeed they were people with lives and stories. And while it's filled with brutality, those people's stories also, encapsulated resilience. And we often look to our ancestors, our enslaved ancestors, to find modeling of resistance. And so as much brutality and terror and tragedy and grief there is in those stories, there's also life and beauty and family and community. And so it's just one small way in which we can honor and recognize the humanity is by using person-centered language.
Great. I appreciate that, especially in such a heavy story as Thomas Coleman. Let's talk about Thomas Coleman for a minute. So Thomas Coleman, he worked as a servant. He has a long and complicated history with how he got here. The family that purchased him and brought him to Utah are a whole other story. That's a whole story of crazy that I'd like to talk about sometime. But he was brought here and he worked in the small African-American community in Utah, which they think was about 50 people. And he had some run-ins with the law before it made the newspapers when it was said that he and another enslaved man fought over two enslaved women. And there was a gunfight over it. And the way that the press, the white Utah press, told it at the time was almost as if it was a sitcom drama. You know, it was definitely for the entertainment of people. But Thomas Coleman eventually, they think he was freed and he worked for Brigham Young, right? And Faramore's Little, who was Brigham Young's nephew?
Right, yeah. He worked at the Salt Lake House and for a couple other businesses that Brigham Young owned with his nephew. So he was enslaved, and then he was also working, which often happens. Sometimes you would be working just for your owner, your master, but then also you might have another job depending on, you know, the time and where and everything like that. So he was doing work for them. He would have been, if he was living in this or, you know, associated with the Black community in Utah at that time, I mean, it's not unlikely to think that he was, you know, he was connected and at least knew everyone. So he knows the other people that are the big players, the other names that we know, Green Flake, obviously Sister Jane, and he would have, there's so many names going on in my head, Sister Jane, I mean, he would have known folks, right? And so, you know, to think, I think oftentimes when we think of those that are enslaved, we think of them as lacking community, but he just happens to be one of those people that his story was kind of erased, so I'm so glad that we're highlighting it because it's quite tragic, but also I like to think of him as kind of walking through the streets of Salt Lake and, you know, saying hello to other members of the community that he knew, some freed people and some enslaved.
And I think the story of his death and the energy that was sort of put into his murder, his lynching, is evidence that he was a threat to people, which means that he was definitely smart. He held some sort of power that threatened the structure. At least that's what Connell O'Donovan, the researcher whose work we have pulled this from, postulates, because he thinks that because Thomas Coleman worked in close proximity to Brigham Young and the mayor of Salt Lake City and all these important people, that as a servant, he would have seen and heard things.
Right. I mean, I think that that's, you know, if you know too much, right, you know, and isn't it interesting that he was so well, you know, connected and would have been an earshot of perhaps sensitive information or insider information. And who knows how that all kind of came out, but certainly it didn't bode well for him in the end. And at the same time, it's interesting to think of now how his history has even been erased. So even within, you know, Mormon history context, there's a lack of talking about him, and perhaps that's a remnant of that kind of smear on his story.
Absolutely. And we can link to Connell O'Donovan's paper on it, which is unpublished, but it's got a lot in there. But he talks about some of these dynamics, and he talks about sort of Coleman's life, what we know of it before. It's hard to find information on free blacks and enslaved people because they weren't allowed the same resources and access to resources that white historians and reporters were. And so Connell O'Donovan brought to light what he could. But let's talk about, why don't we talk about the murder, the sure. lynching. Do you want to read the part from Connell? Why don't you read that first clip?
Sure. So I'll warn, it's pretty graphic. So just, you know, heads up about that. It's pretty graphic. On Monday, December 1866, Thomas Coleman was lured to an obscure place in the late afternoon. Later reports indicated Coleman was called outside of town limits on some pretended errand, some 2 miles to the west of Salt Lake. Once there, he was captured by at least two people, one rumored to have been Porter Rockwell, and he was bashed over the head with a rock. The assailants then took Coleman's own Bowie knife, which was engraved T. Coleman, and they slit his throat so deep that his neck was nearly severed in two. Remember, Young said, have his head cut off. They also slit open his right breast, then castrated him in what surely was a temple-based blood atoning killing, performed on one who had never been allowed to enter the temple or participate in its. In fact, I would argue that this is the clearest act of non-consensual blood atonement in the history of the LDS theocracy. Ooh, need a breath after that.
What Connell's talking about is blood atonement, the doctrine that Brigham Young was teaching about cutting people's heads off. He had given this in a sermon earlier, and the idea was that blood atonement should have been a voluntary act, meaning that if you committed a grave sin that Jesus Christ's own blood could not atone for, then you would have to volunteer yourself to kill your own body, basically, in blood atonement, so you could be saved for your sins. But as Connell O'Donovan points out, Coleman's body was cut up in a blood atonement way. They slit his throat. That's a telltale sign. They carve some markings from the garment on him, and they castrate him. But Thomas Coleman wasn't even allowed in Mormon temples or endowment houses or rituals. So for him to get blood atoned is very interesting.
You know, it's interesting. He was, at his death, he was a freedman. And so he had lived for a little less than a year between his enslavement and when he was freed due to end of the Civil War. And Utah actually did not lead the way in freeing their enslaved folks. They kind of waited till the very last minute when they had no other option but to set their enslaved folks free. So that's tragic, and a tragic that, you know, he lived for such a short time as a free man and then had his life taken so in such heinous violence. It's all so interesting, though, because of the ways in which the blood atonement meets the racialized kind of nature of this crime. Because again, right, a lynching is a hate crime. It's different than a murder because of the racialized or the identity of the person, right? So if you have, that's the difference between a lynching and a murder, is that it's associated usually with race, gender, or sexuality, and has this hate crime nature. We call it a hate crime now, but historically they would have been called lynchings. So not only was this man, you know, lynched in a way that was, I don't want to say traditional of like lynchings of many Black men. I don't want to say traditional or historical, but pretty typical in that often castrated, right? Like that is typically something that is very much part of a lynching of Black men. Hangings, castration, particularly when there's any type of a white woman in the mix. And that was part of the accusation of Thomas Coleman, was that he was in some type of association with a white woman. That's oftentimes the excuse that is used, this vigilante justice to protect the gentility and virtue of white women is to lynch Black men. So that part feels very kind of like American or like American South. But then to meet that with the Mormonism, right? This, the slitting of the throat, the garment, you know, markings on his body, and this blood atonement that is something that he could not have committed to, of course, because he's not allowed in the temple. So really, really tragic. I don't know, Lindsay, what are your thoughts on the way all of those intersections meet?
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think, as we're going to read on, the explanation for his lynching is going to be really suspicious to me. I actually looked into it because Mike Quinn was sourced as someone. So the reason for, we'll get into this, but they blame it on him interacting with white women. And that was sort of the accusation. And it would have been culturally acceptable, I guess, you could say, for people, for Black men to die for interacting with white women. If a Black man even touched or looked at a white woman wrong, they could suffer the consequence of death for that. And people would, you know, turn the other way. But I think that this is an old trope that was used. Like Connell O'Donovan, I think Thomas Coleman knew too much. I think Thomas Coleman was smart. If he survived Frontier Utah for as long as he did, he knew what the rules were. He knew who to talk right to and who not to talk to. So there are still lingering stories that Thomas Coleman maybe had a relationship with a white Mormon woman, and this is why he died. But I disagree. I think Thomas Coleman knew how to survive, and I don't think he would have taken that risk.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that there's a more, I mean, you can't, I don't know how you get more tragic or nefarious or violent than, you know, lynching someone. However, there's more to this story that is unfolding, and that there's more that has so much to do with the really kind of the mob and not gangster mafia also mentality of Brigham Young and his guys, quite honestly, in that this person knew too much, and what they did was they used the fact of his race, of his racialized being, and they created a narrative that everyone was familiar with and could recognize. We will lynch this Black man because he was talking to a white woman or was having associations with white women, and then we're going to carve into his body, let this, or what did they do? They pinned it on him.
Yeah.
Let this be a warning to all other Negroes, right?
No, why don't you read the next paragraph, because it has all the quotes.
The murderers then must have wrapped up his corpse, including his bloody knife and the rock used to brain him, and they cautiously hauled his corpse, likely by wagon, to what is now Capitol Hill. I believe there was only one building on the hill at the time, being the arsenal, which is where the Museum of the Daughters of Utah Pioneer now stands. Coleman's body was left behind the arsenal, arranged on his back with his head to the west, and the bloody rock and knife were placed next to him. Then a pre-made penciled placard was pinned to his chest. Brigham Young Jr. reported in his journal that the Negro, I'm going to not say the real word, but found, had a note reading, "Let this be a warning to all Negroes that they not meddle with white women." They use the N-word. Yeah. However, both the Salt Lake Daily Telegraph, owned by the fringe Mormon TBH Stenhouse and the Daily Union Vedette reported that the placard read, "Notice to all N-words, take warning, leave white women alone." This, of course, leads us to the conclusion that Coleman's murder was race-based hate crime, but the circumstances seem to indicate that this was only a cover-up.
And let's talk about the cover-up for just a minute. He says, "In any case, Coleman's corpse lay behind the old arsenal until the following afternoon when a group of boys playing on the hill found him. The boys reported the corpse right away, but inexplicably, Salt Lake Police Captain Andrew Burt, who was really a Mormon thug at the time, and his squad did not go looking for it until nighttime. The vedette reported that Captain Burt did not find the body until about 9 p.m. on Tuesday, some 28 hours or so after the actual murder." Then I think that this is interesting because it says, "Records for the Salt Lake City Cemetery indicate that Thomas Coleman was also buried in the pauper section on Tuesday, December 11th. Since his corpse was found at 9 p.m. that night, he must have been buried in an extremely rapid fashion to get his corpse in the December ground by midnight. How the Salt Lake Cemetery's gravedigger got a site dug in the pauper section in less than 3 hours on a December night begs the incredible. I have to think that for Coleman to be buried so rapidly midwinter, the cemetery sexton, Jesse C. Little, had made sure that a hole had already been dug for him." That is one of the concerning things about his death, how quickly the grave was dug, but also the fact that people associated with this with Porter Rockwell, the killing is consistent with Porter Rockwell.
I think that there's an interesting point around putting him in the pauper section. Again, even though he was enslaved for the majority of his life, he was a connected person. If you think of another well-connected or enslaved person, you think of Green Flake, right? Green Flake was buried in the Salt Lake Cemetery next to his wife. So if this was purely about the status of Black people in Utah that were enslaved, there's a disparity there for putting him in the pauper section. So clearly this rush to get him, you know, buried so quickly without, you know, any kind of due process in the pauper section is highly suspect.
So there were newspapers at the time that were watching sort of Mormon watchdogs like the Vedette printed by the Soldiers, and they immediately had suspicions about the death. They said there were problems with the death, but also they wondered who testified about seeing Thomas Coleman with a white woman near the place where he was murdered, pointed that surely such a witness would have also seen Coleman's murderers, you know, if they had seen him with a white woman at the time. So anyone that was a witness or was able to place the card on his skin knew something about it. So all of the evidence, just like Robinson's death, doesn't add up. And what Connell O'Donovan theorizes is that Dr. Robinson's murder was such a big deal. It brought on so much pressure from the outside world. And Thomas Coleman was in and out of very important meetings and places as a servant. He probably knew something about this death, and he probably knew too much, and I think he paid the price for it.
Absolutely. And, you know, to me, there's a real kind of like parallel process in his death with kind of the more, you know, systemic kind of nature of all of this, and the ways that Black bodies are used to kind of cover up white sin, white violence. There's an old saying that is often kind of, you know, jokingly kind of, you know, passed around in Black communities that, you know, it's that Black men should stay away from two things. It's pork and white women. Those are dangerous for Black men, pork and white women. But I think that what we see here, much like, you know, with Coleman, it wasn't about white women. It wasn't about, you know, using his Black maleness and being a sexual predator. It had nothing to do with that. It was that he knew what white people were doing that was evil. He saw something, he knew something, and it was his, you know, ultimately the devaluation of his life that allowed him to be lynched so violently. And just like it doesn't matter if Black men do all the right things, say all the right things, even today, they are still going to face the violence of white supremacy. And so you could do all the things right. You can you know, engage in respectability politics. You can do the right thing, say the right thing, stay away from pork and white women, you know, whatever it is that you think is going to keep you safe. But reality is that Black people are not safe in white supremacy, particularly white supremacy that has a mafioso, you know, mob mentality and is doing nefarious illegal activities. And when you start to know all that stuff, you definitely get a target on your back.
Thomas Coleman knew where some of the bodies were buried, and that's a danger, you know?
Yeah, and unlike, you know, perhaps maybe the mentality of, you know, the South, I think that people perhaps had a different perception. People obviously didn't think he was stupid, right? People obviously didn't think that he was unintelligent. People obviously saw him as someone who even though he was the fly on the wall, they assumed, okay, this is something that he could actually organize around, have an intelligence around, and therefore he becomes a threat to us, which is also an interesting, again, kind of like almost power that's given to him, yet that he pays the price for.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Misha. I appreciate you coming on and discussing this story as hard as it is. Is there anything else you want people to know when talking about these things?
You know, I just think that these are, this is why it's so important to read our stories, to read our history, because we've always been there, right? Whether we're the fly on the wall or we are driving the wagon west, Black people have always been a part of the labor and the narratives of this country, of the West, of the American West, and certainly of Mormonism. And so just keep doing this work because it's so, so important. And as we dive into it, we're able to see those parallel processes now and this duality that we can learn from and start to do better.
Yeah, this is a horrific story of racism and extra-legal racism. Sadly, this is also common in the West.
Yeah, it's so important to note that the worst victims of extra-legal violence were the marginalized, especially people of African descent on the frontier.
Yeah, Connell O'Donovan mentions in the same paper about Thomas Coleman the story of another lynching. Let me read that account. Ironically, Andrew Hilbert, the 38-year-old Scottish polygamist who had been a policeman nearly since his arrival in Salt Lake in 1851, would later be gunned down outside the Salt Lake house by a clearly insane and possibly drunk Black man in 1883, resulting in another horrible lynching. Sam Harvey, the 35-year-old crazed Black perpetrator and former U.S. soldier, was subdued by none other than Elijah Abel, the most famous Black Mormon elder. And Harvey was quickly arrested and moved to the city jail, where some 2,000 angry Salt Lake residents gathered while police officers beat him with clubs and brass knuckles. When word came to the jail that Captain Andrew Burt had died from Harvey's gunshots, the police released Harvey to the frenzied crowd. He was beaten and stomped on by the mainly Mormon mob, while others grabbed rope. Leather straps from nearby horse harnesses were used to whip him, and then a noose was thrown over his neck, and he was hung from a beam in the police horse stable. Several prominent white citizens who tried to calm down the crowd and call for a fair trial rather than a lynching were nearly killed themselves. They were only saved because a police officer threw them into a jail cell and locked the door so no one could get at them. After he was dead, Harvey's body was cut down by the mob and dragged down State Street until Mayor William Jennings stopped the madness and dispersed the crowd. Still, Harvey's body was subjected to even more cruelty. His skin was flayed off and apparently his internal organs removed, for only his skeleton was buried, and that not even in the pauper section of the city cemetery, but just outside of it, leaving Sam Harvey literally forever beyond the pale.
Those were our ancestors. Our ancestors did that. That's hard. That's really hard. And Connell links the lynching of Thomas Coleman to the murder of Dr. Robinson as well. He also says, quote, "What really did happen that fateful night of December 10th, 1866? If we accept the findings of the inquest and the evidence of the placard at face value, then it seems that Thomas Coleman was courting, or at least trying to court, a white woman of extremely high status. I could speculate that since Coleman worked for Brigham Young at the Salt Lake House, which was about a block away from the Beehive and Lion House, where he had also apparently worked as a servant of a slave of Young, then perhaps it was one of Young's own daughters who was the white apple of his black eye. Certainly Young and just about only Young could have called up such resources as to have Coleman murdered and then the court case cleaned up and forgotten about so quickly. The alacrity with which Coleman's body was buried and the inquest concluded in less than 18 hours indicates to me that something else was going on. In fact, immediately after his murder and for several years afterwards, reports circulated among the non-Mormon population that Coleman had decided to be an informant against Young and his theocracy. When I realized that in the setting and socio-political context, a black servant is literally invisible to white authorities, it is very reasonable to assume that Coleman was literally the man who knew too much. He was the proverbial fly on the wall that heard conversations between Young and his inferiors that no one else heard. Coleman is said to have known things about the Parrish Potter murders, Connell, this is Connell speaking, in which my own second great uncle, William Parrish, and his sons were murdered when they stopped believing in Mormonism and attempted to peaceably escape from Utah in March 1857. Information on the Mountain Meadows massacre of the first 9/11 in 1857 was also hinted at, but in my opinion, most likely was that Coleman had information or evidence relating to the murder of Dr. John King Robinson, which had occurred less than 2 months earlier, in October of 1866. Another murder even earlier that year is also a possibility, that of Squire Newton Brassfield, misidentified in Bancroft once as Beanfield, end quote. So that's Connell's take. He thinks that Coleman was lynched as it related to the murder of Dr. King Robinson because he knew too much. I mean, we already talked earlier about the murder of Brassfield after he had the audacity to marry a Mormon woman. And some believe that Thomas Coleman came forward with that information about the murder and that led to his lynching. But it's most likely Robinson's murder that he knew something about.
Yeah, other accounts like that of John Gary Maxwell believe that Coleman was likely a witness to the murder and it led to his lynching.
I mean, even Baskins, the Chief Justice who wrote of this, felt like his life was in danger. Check out this account. This is what when he talks about Dr. Robinson being married. He says, quote, and this is from Robert Newton Baskins and the Making of Modern Utah. This is by John Gary Maxwell. It was in this time of threatened and real violence that the murder of Baskins' friend and client, Dr. John King Robinson, took place. This was an unmistakable confirmation of the insecurity of life for non-Mormons in Utah, and the consequences of the event rested painfully on Baskin for the remainder of his life. Robinson, a retired assistant surgeon, formerly with the California Volunteers, had been discharged in December of 1865. He remained in Utah and in March 1866 married Ellen Nellie Kay, the daughter of former Mormon stalwart, alleged henchman for hire, and apostate John Kay, an intimate friend of Reverend Norman McLeod, who himself had survived an 1865 attempt on his life. Robinson attempted to gain title to 80 acres of land that included Warm Springs, a bathing resort whose natural springs waters was desirable. He was planning construction of the hospital with its warm waters, a recuperative feature, but the land was claimed by Mormon leaders for the city of Salt Lake. The acreage claimed was, as with most of the Mormon claims for city boundaries, far in excess of what was allowed by federal land statutes. Robinson was warned by his non-Mormon friends that to contest this property would put his life in jeopardy, a caution underscored when a crowd of men with axes broke the windows, doors, and fixtures of a building belonging to him. When Robinson approached Baskin for legal counsel in obtaining title, Baskin minimized the danger, saying he did not believe it's possible anywhere in the United States that a citizen would jeopardize his life by applying to the courts of the country for an adjudication of his rights. Unfortunately, Baskin lacked the level of concern held by Robinson's friend Captain Stephen E. Jocelyn, also of Connor's Volunteers, who predicted violence. Speaking of Robinson, Jocelyn said, not 3 days before his foul murder, he expressed to me the sense of danger he felt himself exposed to in attempting single-handed fight with the Mormon authorities of Salt Lake City. Robinson certainly knew that 2 weeks earlier, the Union Vedette's fiery anti-Mormon editor-in-chief, Isaac Mellon Weston, was taken at night by the Mormons, brutally beaten, and warned he had 6 hours to leave the city. 7 years old at the time, Evelyn Brooks, who lived with her family at the corner of Main Street and Third South, gave an account of Dr. Robinson's murders. Quote, at midnight, he was called up to attend a man who was supposed to be injured. Just as he left his house, he was hit on the head by a blunt instrument and then shot. Mother and father jumped out of bed, as did we children too. Mother was sure of one of the criminals, but dared not to tell. Fear of violence seized the whole non-Mormon community, she explained. Non-Mormons laid Robinson's death on the doorstep of Brigham Young, a charge supported by the fright experienced by the Brooks family at risk for being able to identify one of the killers. Jocelyn's record also substantiates the fear felt by other witnesses to the killing. Quote, witnesses were unwilling to identify the attackers without adequate assurance of safety for fear their own lives would pay the forfeit. And there are so many accounts like this. People who knew something about this would be in danger. So it makes sense that Thomas Coleman might be in danger too.
So here's what's interesting. Mormon Church historian wrote of this timeline in the events of the murder. Andrew Jensen, he put, on December 13th, Alexander Burt, John L. Blythe, James Toms, and John Brasler were arrested in Salt Lake City, wickedly accused of the murder of Dr. J. King Robinson in 1866. On the 19th, policeman Brigham Young Hampton was arrested on a similar charge. The following day, on December 18th, he writes, an examination of the Robinson murder case was commenced before Justice McKean in chambers and was continued for several days. On the 22nd, Alexander Burt, one of the accused, was discharged from custody. And then in 1872, January 3rd, about a week later, Andrew Jensen writes, Charles W. Baker, the principal witness against Brigham Young Hampton and others, declared under oath that his testimony in court against the accused was utterly false. So after only 1 week, this Charles W. Baker said he was lying in court, and so justice was never served.
Okay, I'm just sitting here thinking about what it would be like to live in Utah, because, you know, I deal with a lot of ex-Mormons now, and it's hard enough for people to leave the church because their families and friends will turn on them. Sometimes people will leave their businesses. But this is something different, right? This is something like if you see something, if you know of any foul play by other Mormons, you keep your mouth shut. And if you're a non-Mormon, what's that like to live in it? Because there's just so much murder happening here. Why?
You know, Lindsay, it's hard to say. I mean, the Wild West in and of itself, there was a lot of murder everywhere. But there did seem to be its fair share, or maybe even a little bit more in Utah. And I don't know the answers to that. I know that there was. I know that it was scary. I think that, again, when you believe that you're in the right, that what you're doing is what God wants you to do, maybe it's easy to make these decisions. I don't know. I can't get in their heads.
I think what's hard for me is that we see a lot of larger society caring about Dr. Robinson's murder because he was a white Easterner surgeon. But when there's lynchings of black men, we just blame it on the fact that they were encroaching on white women, which everyone was doing anyway. And I actually asked Mike Quinn about this because Connell, I think, cites him as a source that says that it was possible that Coleman was hanging out with a white lady. Because I was like, is that true? Because I think that that's a racist thing that, you know, it instills white fear and white panic that black men were hanging out with white people. But Quinn seems to believe that there is some evidence that Thomas Coleman was at least associating with white women, but still, at the very least, that's not why you kill somebody. You don't kill somebody for that. But it is kind of sad that society cared a lot more about the murder of Dr. Robinson, which, don't get me wrong, it was terrible, than they did about the horrific lynchings of black men around the country.
Well, and unfortunately, not much has changed. The marginalized are still marginalized, even 150 years later.
And you're right. Robinson's murder really sends things over the top. It goes international. Remember that resolve I read about in Maine? This is when people really start demanding more and more action from the federal government.
Right, and that's exactly what happened. The federal government came in and started cracking down on extra legal activities from the Mormons.
Well, I guess it's as good a time as any as we start to talk about that.
On the next episode of Sunstone Stories, Crime and Punishment, what do the Utah War and Utah judges have in common?
They both were at the mercy of Brigham Young?
You'll have to wait to find out.
Sunstone depends on your generous support. Please sign up for a recurring donation at sunstone.org and support this and many other projects.